Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. This year marks the 100th anniversary of the Volstead Act, which banned the manufacture, sale, and transportation of liquor in the U.S. Women are most often credited with the prohibitionist movement and all the bad stuff that went with it, but men were far more prominent at the time. In this recording, prominent orator and prohibitionist Clinton N. Howard explained his take on the evils of alcohol.
With the bar lined with the boys and bums, spending their money, debauching their characters, rotting their bodies, and jeopardizing their immortal souls.
But during Prohibition, other evils flourished, including organized crime, catapulting mobsters such as Al Capone into the national spotlight and entrenching the culture in the American political, criminal, and social landscape. Thomas Pegram is an author and professor of history at Loyola University in Maryland. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
So Prohibition wasn't about drinking alcohol. It was about selling it and transporting it. Why is that distinction important?
The movement from temperance to prohibition was really part of a reform progressive attempt to take away the power of the liquor industry. There were prohibitionists who objected to people drinking, but as a political movement, in a practical way, they aimed at eliminating the saloon and eliminating the liquor industry.
Right, but they didn't think about the demand at all?
Demand was important, but some of the prohibitionists in the Anti-Saloon League argued that once there were controls and firm controls and national uniform controls over access to alcohol, then education programs could help people learn to live without excess drinking. And also, they argued that other social reforms would follow in the absence of alcohol.
Such as?
Greater longevity, public health. The Women's Christian Temperance Union, which is one of the major women's organizations, carried out scientific temperance instruction in the schools, textbooks that tried to illustrate that alcohol was a poison. Industry, a lot of people used to drink on the job, drink during the day. With greater mechanization, there are more and more industrial accidents. There could also be greater efficiency from having kind of a sober workforce. And there is a belief that working class people could use their income more productively, and working class households would be more healthy and secure without alcohol.
There was post-prohibition, there was a reduction in the number of Americans who drank, right?
Drinking went down and stayed down for about 40 years. It wasn't until 1970 that the pre-prohibition drinking rates, this is when there were state prohibition laws, mm-hmm. of around 1915 were reached. So yes, Americans were more temperate in their drinking after prohibition.
I read that at least one arm of the movement was actually more focused on immigrants and Catholics, that kind of a thing, that they thought the immigrants and particularly Catholics brought the boozing to the U.S. in the first place.
There was a nativist wing in the prohibition movement. Some of the professional organizations like the Anti-Saloon League tried to downplay that, but it was certainly present, even in the ASL. And the argument was that immigrant customs, particularly drinking customs, a lot of issues on the Sabbath. Sundays used to be very strictly regulated, no baseball games, no horse racing. It's the only day when working class people had a full day off. So for working class and immigrant cultures, particularly people coming from Europe, where the notion of drinking wasn't of solitary men drinking away their wages, but of family picnics and beer gardens and sociability, it was a real social conflict.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. 2019 is the 100th anniversary of the Volstead Act, which banned the manufacture, sale, and transportation of liquor in the U.S. That's what we're talking about today, kind of the legacy of prohibition. When it was repealed, of course, the law went into effect in 1920. It was repealed 13 years later. And when it was repealed, the world does not return to pre-Volstead Act days. My guest is Thomas Pegram. He's author and professor of history at Loyola University in Maryland. He's written about this extensively. Coming up, we're going to hear from the Anti-Saloon League Museum at the Westerville Public Library. And also someone from a historian at the Andrew J. Volstead House Museum in Minnesota. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Tom, when did the public start to see the negatives of prohibition? When did that start to emerge?
It really was there at the outset, but it worsened over the course of the dry decade. There were still 21 states that did not have their own state prohibition regulations when the 18th Amendment was passed in Congress. This is before it was ratified. And in those areas, there was population that remained opposed to the law on states' rights grounds, on cultural and ethnic autonomy grounds. On top of that, enforcement was always a problem in prohibition. There never was enough money that was allocated for proper enforcement. Also, in order to get the prohibition bill passed and then ratified as a constitutional amendment, there was a requirement for concurrent enforcement, both state and federal enforcement at the same time. And most states did not fund their prohibition efforts. They just relied on the federal officials. And in fact, by 1923, 24, 25, several states actually repealed their state enforcement laws.
That made the FBI a very powerful agency, did it not?
The FBI became important during this period. It was the Treasury Department that was enforcing prohibition initially.
Gotcha.
Through the IRS, actually. It's only later that it moves to the Justice Department. And actually, when it moves to the Justice Department, that marks a period of more efficient enforcement, in at least in administrative ways, because those agents were under civil service status. Mm-hmm. Early on, they weren't. They were often political appointees, which is kind of what Wayne Wheeler, who's the main figure in the Anti-Saloon League, wanted, because he could use his power over members of Congress to influence those appointments. But it created a lot of problems.
I read that the winemakers of California were really caught off guard by prohibition and weren't ready. It was probably one of the industries that suffered the most from it.
There were many drinking Americans that were caught off guard by prohibition because the 18th Amendment regulates bans intoxicants, but it didn't define what they were. It's the Volstead Act that defines what is an intoxicating liquor, and it defined it at 0.5% alcohol, which was actually a measurement used for taxation purposes. Many Americans going into prohibition thought that beer was not intoxicating. There's a great division between brewers and distillers. It's one reason why they couldn't hold off prohibition, because they kept fighting amongst one another. So the wine industry was hit hard, but it did adjust. There were ways in which homemade winemaking — Americans weren't wine drinkers much in the 1920s, but one of the ways around prohibition was through home manufacture, and there were little kits that would allow you to make wine. Even they would say, don't do this and don't do that, because that would ferment the grapes, and you know, you might get wine as a result.
But the
wine industry really took a punch, as did the liquor industry as a whole during Prohibition. In the post-Prohibition world, it's a different landscape of alcohol producers.
Right. I mean, because they got a lot of the booze came in from outside. Canada played a huge role in that.
Canada and the Caribbean. Canada also, most Americans don't know this, but Canada also had prohibition laws during this period. But they quickly revised them, and they allowed for production for export, which the United States didn't do. So liquor could be brought in illegally, had to be smuggled in, from Canada. But that doesn't mean that Americans, by and large, had access to high-quality alcohol. What would happen was when those professionally made distilled liquors came into the United States, then distributors and criminal gangs, in some cases, would cut the alcohol, they'd water it down, they would color it, they would add other elements. So you weren't getting the real stuff unless you were, like, at the Yale Club.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and by the way, I mean, a lot of people think, well, how could the Roaring Twenties have happened? Kind of in plain sight. Again, the consumption wasn't the problem. You could be, you know, drinking as much as you want. But the speakeasies were a problem because they were public. But privately, you could drink as much as you wanted.
You could. In fact, one of the elements of the law that raised kind of class complaints was that pre-Volstead purchases, that is, purchases before the Volstead Act was passed, you could keep those at home. You could drink them at home. You couldn't take them outside home. And you could serve them to what were called bona fide guests. You couldn't sell them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, wealthy people had that option. Ordinary people did not. And that led to a lot of grousing during the Prohibition years.
I wanted to grab a few questions real quick before we move on. Let's see. Mike in Columbus, you're on the air with Thomas Pegram. He's an author and professor of history at Loyola University. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I was wondering about the taxation portion of it. Was it being taxed before Prohibition? Was it taxed afterwards? And if it was taxed, did it have an effect on the economy?
Hmm.
This is actually a good question, mm-hmm. and it became part of the push for repeal after the Depression hit, you know, the economic market, the economic argument. Saloons were taxed. And in fact, in the period prior to the national income tax, so this is earlier in the 20th century, saloon licenses were major, major revenue makers for cities. On top of that, distilled liquor did pay an excise tax. That's why even pre-Prohibition years, you had revenuers out trying to close down illegal stills. It's
right.
Because the excise tax hadn't been paid. And so during the Prohibition period, one of the major groups of critics, the Association Against the Prohibition Amendment, was made up largely of industrialists, the DuPonts and others. And one of their arguments was that, A, the national government had shut down a legitimate industry, and B, because of the lost tax revenue from the closing of those industries, other businesses were taxed to make up for it.
I thought, and correct me if I'm wrong, of course, but I think I learned this from the Ken Burns series on Prohibition, that one of the political, some of the back trading in the politics of this was that the anti-saloon, the prohibitionists wouldn't fight an income tax.
Right. The income tax was already in place.
Okay.
So that was an issue that was resolved. Initially, the tax issue wasn't at the forefront. You know, personal liberty was,
mm-hmm.
Federal power, states' rights, issues like that. But as we moved deeper into the decade, and especially when the the Depression hit, the tax issue became a major one.
We are talking about Prohibition. It was 100 years ago this year that the Volstead Act was enacted, which put into force the amendment to the Constitution that banned the sale and transportation of alcohol, wine, beer, liquors. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guest is still Thomas Pegram. He's an author and professor of history at Loyola University in Maryland. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
How do you turn what you love into a career? On season 2 of the Rivet podcast from WOSU, hear firsthand from students translating their interests into jobs without college. Listen to This American Graduate Project as we highlight the next generation of workers in the state's top industries of agriculture, insurance, and healthcare. Support for the Rivet podcast series comes from COSI. Subscribe now at wosu.org/rivet, on the WOSU mobile app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. This year marks the 100th anniversary of the Volstead Act. That's the act that put into effect the constitutional amendment that banned the manufacture, sale, and transportation of liquor in the U.S. Much of the work against the sale of alcohol took place right here in central Ohio in the Columbus suburb of Westerville after the Anti-Saloon League moved its headquarters there from Washington, D.C. Still with us is author and historian Thomas Pegram of Loyola University. Joining us from the Westerville Public Library, where she manages the History Center and Anti-Saloon League Museum, is Nina Thomas. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So why did the Anti-Saloon League move its headquarters to Westerville?
Well, they were looking for a place to set up their printing center primarily. They were going to be pushing for national prohibition, whereas before they were really pushing for states to vote themselves dry. But they got to a place where they realized we need an amendment to the Constitution to force all those urban areas
that controlled so many votes.
Yes, to go dry. And so their primary purpose in Westerville actually sent them a letter or a list of why we would be such a great place for them to move. And then they moved here and set up their printing center in 1909 and began printing and shipping large amounts of propaganda, printed materials, marketing.
Was that an effective tack, Thomas Pegram?
Oh, yeah. The Anti-Saloon League's avalanche of publicity was very, very effective in the prohibition fight. They also worked through the churches. The ASL called itself the Church in Action Against the Saloon. Not all churches, though. Protestant churches and mainly Protestant evangelical churches. But the publicity from the print work in Westerville that was supervised by Ernest Charrington, who was a key figure in the Prohibition drive. It was absolutely essential. The Anti-Saloon League was really the first single interest issue group in the United States that could effectively force its concerns onto the national consciousness.
There was a thing known as the Whiskey War that took place in Westerville, and it attracted the attention of the Anti-Saloon League as well. What was that about, Nina Thomas?
So Westerville, in its early ordinances, 1858, prohibited the sale of alcohol except for medicinal purposes. And so, of course, we have the ledger book for a pharmacy uptown that sold alcohol to all the sick people in Westerville. But at that same time, the state came out with a new legislation that prohibited local municipalities from prohibiting saloons. So that opened up a pathway for a man named Henry Corbin to open up a saloon. So he opened up a saloon in 1875. People were very upset about it. They picketed it, protested
it. It was right there in Westerville.
Yes. And still, the building still stands. It's on Main Street today. But so when he opened it, people were very upset. But he was bound and determined to be there. And eventually, it was dynamited. We don't know who did that.
It was destroyed.
Well, there were two.
Okay.
There were two different saloons, actually. So that one was rebuilt and stayed. But in 1879, another man opened up a saloon, and then Henry Corbin bought that one, began managing it as a saloon, and that one was also dynamited. You could feel the explosion from 7 miles away.
These are terrorist acts,
yes.
Are they not, Tom Pegram?
Yes. Yes. And the 1920s, actually, outside of Prohibition, there was a wave of bombings in the United States. The Wall Street bombing, there are bombings associated with the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s. It was a scary period for Americans, and the introduction of some of these divisive issues led some jittery people to want to step back from that.
Westerville became the smallest town in the U.S., to have a first-class post office because of the mailing that went in and out of there. How else did the status as the home of the Anti-Saloon League affect the development of the city?
Well, the Anti-Saloon League came in and started building houses. So Westerville was a town of about 2,000 when they moved in. They hired about 200 people on their staff.
10%, yeah.
Yeah, and they paid between their homes and the buildings that they managed, 1/7 of the property taxes were paid by the Anti-Saloon League. So they were a huge force in our community. We have a whole area of town now. It's a historic district called Temperance Row where all the houses were built during that time. And so they were involved also. Some of the wives of the male leaders were on boards, school board, library board. I mean, they were very much involved in our community.
And by the way, Thomas Pegram, the demonization of women as the leaders of the movement, they couldn't even vote at the time.
Yeah, the 19th Amendment, which came after the 18th Amendment, of course, gave women the right to vote on the national level. Women could vote in some states and some municipalities across the country. Yes, that was one reason why the Anti-Saloon League was a male-focused organization, because they were interested in mobilizing voters. Their major threat to office holders was, look, we want you to support this dry law, at whatever level it is, local option all the way to prohibition. And if you support it, we'll steer our votes toward you, whether you're a Democrat, whether you're a Republican, whether you drink or not yourself. If you don't support our issue, we will mobilize our voters to vote you out of office. And they did that against the governor of Ohio in the early part of the 20th century, Myron Herrick. And so people listened to it. So women were involved, but the spear edge of the push for prohibition through legislative action were men.
Where did they get their money from, Nina Thomas?
From all over. I know it was a church, as he said, a church in action against the saloon. Mm-hmm. Many of the churches supported the Anti-Saloon League. They were receiving tons of money from all over, average citizens, so much money. In fact, at the post office, the Anti-Saloon League hired a private investigator to sit up above where in a building above where they could view in the post office to see if people were stealing money. And some people actually served time for stealing money. That was how much money they were receiving at the time.
What about the Catholic Church at that time, Tom?
The Catholic Church, it stressed temperance. That is, not banning alcohol, but using alcohol responsibly.
It's part of the Mass.
Yes, and in fact, this is one of the elements of the Volstead Act, that there was an allowance of both medicinal alcohol and sacramental alcohol, and you'd have to get special permits for it. But Catholics tended to see prohibition as a part of a cultural war against them and their families and their church. The Anti-Saloon League included a small number of Catholics who were prohibitionists in its organization. They tried to stress that they were non-denominational, but they actually were. it was a Protestant movement. Catholics felt threatened.
Well, as well they should have, if what I read was correct, in that the movement of prohibition led to opportunities for the Ku Klux Klan. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's 100 years since the Volstead Act was enacted that gave force to the 16th Amendment that banned the sale and transport of alcohol in the United States. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guests are Nina Thomas. She manages the History Center and the Anti-Saloon League Museum at the Westerville Public Library. The Anti-Saloon League famously moved to Westerville from Washington, D.C., set up shop there. Also with us, Thomas Pegram. He's author and professor of history at Loyola University in Maryland. And Thomas, you've written a history of the Ku Klux Klan. And can you tell us what the relationship was between that arguably terrorist organization and the prohibitionists?
Prohibition was one of the major issues for the Klan in northern states and in a lot of communities, essentially because the Klan argued that it was a law enforcement organization. It was distressed to see a constitutional amendment that was not being enforced. And in fact, Klansmen volunteered to become essentially deputy constables to enforce prohibition in many states. Added to that was the target of many of those raids just happened to be the same groups that the Klan was opposing, African-Americans, immigrants, Catholics. So it was a kind of dovetailing of these two elements.
Was there evidence of the Klan activity around Westerville at all?
Yes, and especially in the 1920s, we have articles in our public opinion, our local paper, that talk about the massive crowds that they were inviting. But one thing we just found out recently was after Henry Corbin's saloon dynamiting, there was another multiple saloon dynamiting in Dublin, Ohio, and the Klan was blamed for that. So that happened in the 1870s. So I don't know how much Klan activity was in Westerville at the time, but that's just information we just found out a couple weeks ago as we were doing research.
Huh. And it grew the Klan, did it not, Tom?
Yes. The Klan for the first half of the 1920s grew astonishingly large, somewhere between 3 and 4 million members with a lot of sympathizers. And that's in a country of about 100 million. So you're talking 3 to 4% of the population of the nation being in this organization, many people just for a short period of time. Mm-hmm. People joined the Klan for lots of reasons. It was a fraternal association for white Protestant men. But prohibition enforcement and the danger that the lack of enforcement of prohibition and the controversy over prohibition meant for the dominance of native-born white Protestant culture was a key element in stirring up Klan activism.
The title of Thomas Pegram's book that I referenced is 100% American, The Rebirth and Decline of the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s. So what did the decline of the Klan have to do with, did the repeal, I should say, of prohibition have anything to do with the decline at that time?
The Klan was already declining prior to that because of internal dissension and scandals. Including murders and including alcohol scandals among some of its leaders. So it was already on the way down. But I think it's probably fair to say that prohibition was damaged more by its connection to the Klan than the Klan was by its connection to prohibition.
You know, Westerville remained dry for most of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. It didn't, you know, which really hurt the restaurant business there for a while. How come, Nina?
Well, I think it was the strong, powerful force of the Anti-Saloon League being in town.
Still,
because when the Cullen Harrison Act was passed in 1932, it allowed for low alcohol content beer and wine to be introduced back into America before the repeal.
Okay.
And so we had a local pool hall that began serving the 3.2 beer. And he was quoted in the paper as saying, you know, I've got plenty of beer, but people are too scared to drink it. I hate the Anti-Saloon League type of thing. And there were people that they formed the Westerville Law Enforcement Committee at that time. And so Anti-Saloon Leaguers, other people in town joined that to try to still prohibit people from drinking. And so that was short lived. Westerville quickly voted itself dry and remained dry until 2004.
A lot of cities did. I grew up in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Tom, where that was the case for a long time. I mean, there were no you know, bowling alleys were closed. I mean, there was all kinds of things that were affected by this.
Right. After the end of prohibition, liquor regulation went back to where, basically to the level of scaffolding that the Anti-Saloon League and other temperance folk had built up to the point of national constitutional prohibition. And that meant, in some cases, state prohibition, local option, Sunday blue laws. Added to that were state stores, dispensaries.
In Ohio.
Like in Virginia, Pennsylvania, several other states would control especially distilled liquor sales mm-hmm. through state stores.
Ohio
so
still
a,
does,
a,
yeah.
A map of a crazy quilt of liquor regulation after prohibition.
And that made it hard for, you know, some of those laws still challenge distilleries, still challenge winemakers 100 years later. I know it was only in the last few years that the laws changed in Ohio to allow distilleries to sell their product from the distillery itself. That was a really big deal and really held back the craft distillery movement in Ohio. Likewise, beer. There were other laws that changed for that. And then wine as well. But obviously, the wine business has recovered. But some of those laws still challenge them, right?
Oh, yes. I live in Maryland. And until a few years ago, you could not get wine shipped to you in state. The post-prohibition law that was supported by the retailers and the warehousemen required that any wine that was bought in the state had to sort of go through them. So until very recently, you couldn't get mail orders.
I wanted to talk as well about, well, first of all, before Nina, before I let you go, we should ask what finally tipped, changed in Westerville to, was it just the voters?
Yeah, it was the voters. In the election in 2004, it was still controversial. So you still had two sides of the issue. People were scared that Westerville would become like OSU campus and High Street. And
well, it is a lot busier.
It is busier. Yes, it is busier. And people had a lot of reasons to oppose it. But public opinion was changing. People really felt like we're never going to get any decent restaurants uptown if we can't serve alcohol. The voting district also included a lot of Otterbein student housing. So some of the college students had a say in voting that as well. But after that, we have breweries uptown. You can get wine. You can get cocktails, anything. So it's really has changed since 2004.
Yeah, a lot of change in just the last 15 years. There are still dry places in the country, though, right, Tom?
Oh, sure. Sure. There are some places where you can't get liquor by the drink. There are others where there are no liquor stores. Because we're a mobile people now, you know, with cars, it's easier to get around that. But yes, they're dry pockets across the country, and sometimes when you're traveling or you move, you encounter them.
We will be right back. I have Nina Thomas, manager of the History Center and the Anti-Saloon League Museum at the Westerville Public Library, and also Thomas Pegram. He's author and professor of history at Loyola University in Maryland. If you have a question or comment about what we're talking about, which is the legacy of Prohibition in the United States, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from Early Music in Columbus, presenting Stile Antico in Queen of Muses. This innovative vocal ensemble brings to life music from the court of Elizabeth I. Friday, November 8th at 8 in the Trinity Episcopal Church. Details at earlymusicincolumbus.org.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. This year marks the 100th anniversary of the Volstead Act, which banned the manufacture, sale, and transportation of liquor in the U.S., or I guess it gave enforcement powers to the 16th Amendment, which banned those things. We're talking about the legacy of Prohibition today. Still with us is author and historian Thomas Pegram of Loyola University, also manager of the Westerville History Center and Anti-Saloon League Museum at the Westerville Public Library, Nina Thomas. Joining us is historian at the Andrew J. Volstead House Museum and professor at Southwest Minnesota State University, Melanie Gabbert-Gatchell. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Melanie, notably, Volstead himself was a drinker.
Yes. Yeah, he was not a teetotaler. He didn't drink to excess, but he certainly had a drink. There's been accounts of when he went to visit family, that they would offer Uncle Andrew a cordial and he would take it. So, yeah, he wasn't against it for personal use, and, you know, as long as you kept it in tow.
Right. So he wasn't considered a hypocrite at the time. He was considered a social progressive, in fact. And I'm just wondering how our image of him has changed over time.
Well, they needed someone to villainize, in a sense, when you take away something that many people enjoy and sometimes use to excess. They kind of really needed him as a villain. Also, with him being Norwegian, many people would call him un-American because of him putting up this law, which affected so many different cultures that already had drinking within their culture. So,
was he unpopular in his district?
No, actually, people knew him in Granite Falls. He owned a lot of land in Granite Falls, and he was known as a fair man. He was known as someone who was for women's rights and for men's rights. He did not speak ill of people, and he would actually go out to the farms that he owned and he was renting to farmers and ask them if they would need help in the fields, because he would show up to collect rent and he'd be in overalls and he would give candy to the kids and he would ask the family if they needed help, and if they did, he'd go out in the field and help them because he was from a farm family, so they respected him.
Tom Pegram, why Volstead? Why was he the one to carry this mantle?
It's a lot of historians think that Volstead was manipulated by Wayne Wheeler, the legal counsel and the chief lobbyist of the Anti-Saloon League. Some go so far as to say that Wheeler wrote the Volstead Act. Others say that there was a collaboration. His placement on committees was helpful, but it's interesting, the question about why was Volstead vilified. Partly it may have been because Wayne Wheeler died in 1927. He had a heart attack. He dropped dead, and he was the main villain at the time.
Huh.
Maybe in retrospect, things fall on Volstead because his name is part of the legislation.
Displaced aggression. Melanie Gabber-Gatchell, what about that? I mean, how did he feel about how he was viewed after Prohibition went into effect?
Well, he didn't want to be known for Prohibition. He wanted to be known more for the Capper-Volstead Act, which still stands today. And so that hurt him quite deeply to be villainized. Wayne Wheeler tried to put the bill into Congress multiple times, and when it kept getting shot down, he actually went to Mr. Volstead, because he was the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, and of course that would be his responsibility to help people write bills if they needed help. And Andrew basically looked at it and he said, well, I can do better. Because Prohibition was in about 80% of the country already at that time, because again, with the 18th Amendment, the law was out there.
Mm-hmm.
He took what individual states and cities and even counties did that were working and put them into his own words, into his own act. That's why it's 25 pages long. And he was a wordsmith. He was very proud of his actual wording. So he took Wheeler's idea, but he then perfected it, if you will, and looked for loopholes. So he was proud of the contribution he made that way, in that it was such an interesting piece of work. But again, he did not take into account how it was going to affect people personally.
Right. You've said that he didn't take into account personal addictions and the things that drove people to work, drove people to drink, which often was work. but why not? I mean, is there any evidence that he even thought about that kind of issue?
Well, again, he cared deeply about people, but Andrew was a very quiet and, you know, reserved person. He did not like to go out to parties in Washington. When he did, it was because his wife and daughter wanted to go. Mm-hmm. And at first he started, you know, going with them. But he didn't like the idle chit-chat. And he didn't like wearing the gloves. And, you know, being around. He just was not that type of a person. So back in Granite Falls and in Washington, his spare time was spent reading Shakespeare and Thoreau and Dickinson,
Mm-hmm.
And he was in the garden a lot in Granite Falls. So he did speak with people. He did socialize, but for the most part, he was very much a thoughtful person who was in his head a lot. So, you know, you tend to forget people around you and how things affect them. And because Hugh almost was a minister at one point, he figured that people were already following the Ten Commandments. That was a law. So him putting laws into place was just another extension of that, and people should follow laws. So that was kind of a simplistic view, but really he was very much a straight arrow that way.
You know, Nina Thomas, Wayne Wheeler working out of the Anti-Saloon League right there in Westerville, what was he like? He sounds manipulative.
Yeah, but. And I mean, all the accounts that I read, he wasn't in Westerville a lot. He's very, very busy
in
and very
Washington.
Much out and involved. Yeah. But, you know, he has a very dramatic story as to why he joined the anti-alcohol movement. He stated that his father was chased by a man with a drunken man with a pitchfork, and it was very traumatic for him. And so he felt very strongly about, you know, he felt very strongly anti-alcohol. And so I think he kind of carried that with him. He was very passionate. I would probably use the word aggressive.
Yeah. Right. Tom Pegram or.
Yes.
Or
oh, yeah. He was. I mean, he was known as the dry boss, the master of the Senate. And he was this small man. He had a tight little grin. But he was an excellent lawyer. He was a political mastermind, one could say, and he was just like a terrier. He wouldn't let go. And in fact, when Wheeler died, some elements of the Anti-Saloon League said, we've got to cast aside Wheelerism now. We can't think of the next election. We have to think of the next generation. And we've got to try to educate people rather than just bludgeon them with laws.
But he did famously create this organization. As you said, it was the first of its kind that was a single-issue organization. And I can't imagine people haven't taken notes on it ever since.
It's the basis for a lot of single-issue political groups. In fact, several years ago when the Moral Majority arose, it just kind of reminded me of the Anti-Saloon League in some ways. Not as effective politically, but yeah, it's the model.
You know, Melanie Gabbert-Gatchell, we were talking earlier about the impact, the long-term impact until 2004 of the Anti-Saloon League being in Westerville, Ohio, a suburb of Columbus where we're at. What about, is there any long-term legacy of having, of being from where Andrew J. Volstead lived and represented as a member of Congress?
Well, if you think about it, Minnesota still was not allowing the public sale of alcohol on Sundays up until a few years ago. So, you know, that was still around. But I think what happened with Prohibition affects how we handle people with addictions today and how we view them, that we can't just, you know, put a moral compass on it and say, that's it, and if you cross the line, you're done. We've learned from those mistakes.
Did that start a movement of learning more about alcoholism?
Oh, I think so. I'm sure, because it became something that was personal and usually behind closed doors. It was brought out into the public. It was brought out into the streets. People learned about it and knew that it wasn't just them or their families that had these problems. And people started to be able to talk more about it or at least address them in public, whereas before it was always kind of a quiet thing or it was behind the doors of the saloons.
So that's a good thing, right, Tom Pegram?
Yes. I mean, one of the things that came out of it was that historians of alcohol talk about is the disease concept of alcoholism. I mean, there was a sense of alcoholism. There was an Anti-Saloon League offshoot organization called the World League Against Alcoholism. So the term was used. But their emphasis really was on removing the supply, not really treating the what they would call the inebriate or the person who has the addiction. There is, in both everyday and in clinical ways, I think Prohibition has shaped the way Americans approach alcohol. The way we drink now It's not in male-only environments by the most part. For the most part, it's in restaurants. There was one of the things that speakeasy culture did was create a breakdown in some cities of racial barriers in drinking spaces. Certainly, of gender barriers in drinking spaces. Drinking as part of an entertainment culture, what's known as a heterosocial network, as opposed to this male-dominated interior saloon culture. And I think the same is true in the approach to alcoholism and problem drinking.
Mm. So it's interesting, the dichotomy. It became more egalitarian in some ways, but there are other bad things. And one of them was the sophistication of what became organized crime syndicates, that whole thing. Right, Thomas Pegram? I mean, how long before abolitionists realized, ruh-roh, there's this whole, underground economy going on that's generating a lot of crime?
The prohibition crime wave, as it was called, did bother lots of people, and it was one of the major elements of people thinking that maybe just the law wouldn't be enforced.
Uh-huh.
They didn't think it could really be repealed because nobody had repealed the constitutional amendment. It took the Depression to do that. But organized crime had existed prior to prohibition, but prohibition opened up an angle of enterprise that allowed young immigrant men. A lot of these criminal organizations were from ethnic backgrounds that had not penetrated into the existing criminal gangs. And just as criminals now kind of take cigarettes across the border, you know, that haven't been properly taxed and sell them, liquor provided that kind of opportunity. But the problem was with those businesses, they would often fight literally over territory.
Well, Al Capone, I was reading about him. He, of course, is well known for being the one that was busted for tax evasion. But he was bringing in something like $100 million a year. And at the time, that would be equivalent to about $1.2 billion in today's dollars. He became these incredible amounts of money, and that started the whole, you know, shipping the money out of the country just to be able to launder it. There was so much.
Some of these criminal enterprises were just brought in a lot of cash. There was a demand for alcohol. Those who could provide better quality alcohol, and mainly that's why they didn't deal with beer. They dealt, for the most part, with distilled liquor. You got to drink a lot of beer to fill, and so it's harder to.
Not anymore, not with craft beers, but go ahead.
Yeah, that's right, Belgians. Distilled liquor, you know, it could be fit into, you know, you get a punch from a bottle. So there were kind of characteristics of the product that kind of fit into the criminal enterprise, the coastline, the border of Canada, the large unpatrolled space in the West. There are a lot of reasons why criminal syndicates became involved.
And Melanie Gabbert-Gatchell, did Andrew Volstead have thoughts about the criminal enterprises that sprung from Prohibition?
Well, of course, he had lots to consider because when he became, you know, once he lost his seat in Congress and he became the legal advisor to the Prohibition director of the Northwestern Dry Enforcement District up in St. Paul, he lived, you know, with the Landmark Center, they were trying people who were gangsters. And he had offices in that same building. He was getting death threats. His daughter was getting death threats. So certainly he knew about it. It affected him even after when he was retired in 1933, when it was repealed. He went back to Granite Falls. He would get crank calls in the middle of the night of people giving him death threats. So it's certainly something that didn't just disappear. He knew about it, but he really didn't want to talk much about it because he was afraid his words would get misconstrued and used against him. So he never really spoke about his time in Congress with people. He wouldn't talk to reporters. So, yeah, he knew that crime was a bad thing, and he was hoping that it would have been slowed down, but instead it became something romanticized. And that was not necessarily, I would call it an embarrassment, but certainly, you know, I'm sure he wasn't too happy with the knowledge that that was brought about because of, you know, his part of his act in Prohibition.
Well, Melanie Gabbert-Gatchell, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
Melanie Gabbert-Gatchell is a historian at the Andrew J. Volstead House Museum and a professor at Southwest Minnesota State University. Also, Nina Thomas, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Nina Thomas is manager of the History Center and the Anti Saloon League Museum at the Westerville Public Library. Thomas Pegram, thank you so much for all your time today. Appreciate it.
No, thanks. It's been a fun conversation.
Thomas Pegram is an author and professor of history at Loyola University in Maryland. Thanks to the Allside staff, producers Mary Lee Williams and Kyle McKinnon, Allside's interns Atiya Ture, Tatiana Woodall, and Bobby Gerberic, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Alan DiCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks for listening. This is Allside's with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.